Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot. You need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow, because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face Off is about to begin. Yeah, welcome to Legal
Face Off. Legal Face Off. We are ending October with a bang here, as is the Donald Trump administration, a little bit, it seems. And we have to get right to topics like this. We have the managing director of the Berkeley Research Group, Jeffrey Kramer, in. You are a former federal prosecutor, assistant U.S. attorney, certainly qualified to talk on this. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
Jeff, by now our listeners know the news involving Manafort and George Papadopoulos and Rick Gates. Those are the three people that were charged yesterday by special counsel Robert Mueller. I read the complaint. I'm sure you did, given that you are an expert in this area and a frequent guest on many shows. It struck me that the complaint was very detailed. You file these complaints, you know, dozens, hundreds of times. Was this more detailed than normal? And if so, why?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's what I'd call a speaking indictment. I mean, it tells a tale. You're, you know, a dozen pages in before you get to any counts. And that's not a coincidence. Mueller, when he was drafting the indictment, easily could have just put the counts, but instead he went through in painstaking detail the companies that were set up overseas, how the money was made, who owned the companies, the wire transfers, the purchases that were made, you know, the suits, the landscaping. He had houses that were purchased and property. He had the mortgage documents to get the money out. And he had some lies to the FBI. So as you read that indictment, it's like reading a novel. And I think that blunts any argument that this is anything but a strong case.
So to that point, you know, I think it's safe to say that, as you just mentioned, it wasn't by coincidence. What is Bob Mueller thinking when he writes that complaint, when his team writes that complaint? And how important is it to send a message? You're someone who on our show on many occasions has talked about the importance in the U.S. Attorney's Office of sending a message, right? We've certainly covered that in high-profile cases like Blagojevich, the importance of sending a message to others who might be thinking of committing similar crimes. So my question to you is, when Mueller wrote that specific speaking complaint, how much was he trying to send a message not only to other potential defendants, but to the Trump administration that, hey, we've got a lot more here and our case really is fairly strong?
Yeah, I think there were a couple messages sent yesterday. The first to Paul Manafort is basically, I got you. There's no viable, I mean, it's hard to say there's no defense to any indictment, but as you look at this, even as an objective observer, there's no defense here. You can't cross-examine a document. You can't cross-examine a wire transfer. It is what it is. So that's the message to Manafort. And as a 68-year-old guy who's looking at 10 to 15 years in prison, that's a lot of reason to maybe cooperate. Another message that was sent yesterday is on the other track, the Papadopoulos indictment and plea agreement that he was already locked in. That said a couple things to the street and certainly to the Trump administration. One is that we're on this track of Russian collusion. The other is that this guy has been out there for 3 months already cooperating with law enforcement. So if you had a conversation with George Papadopoulos anytime in July, August, September, or early October, you're going to need to think about what you said to him, because the chances are pretty good Bob Mueller knows what you said to him, and he may have even heard your voice if he sent him back in wired. Now, he can't go in wired to a represented individual if someone's got a lawyer, but at that level where he was playing Papadopoulos, he probably wasn't too many people that were had lawyers. So if you went in and talked to Mueller before, you're probably calling him today and saying you want to revisit your statement, because the last message that was sent is that this special prosecutor will indict you for lying to the FBI and nothing else. No substantive charges, just lying. So I think there was a lot of messages sent yesterday.
And then there's a, you know, I think there's a very real carrot and stick here that the street sees, right? The street sees the carrot being Papadopoulos, who pled guilty and presumably is going to, you know, have a deal worked out, versus the stick, which is Manafort, which, hey, if you don't cooperate, we're going to bring you in front of everyone and charge you with a federal crime.
Absolutely. And, you know, the old saying, you know, first guy on the bus gets the best seat, and that's Papadopoulos. The corollary of that is the 68-year-old guy who's going to sell Block D for 10 to 15 years. It's a pretty stark contrast.
Well, clearly this is just the beginning. Where do you think we're headed with all of this in the coming days and weeks?
You know, I think there's going to be a lull for a little while. And we also know from this that Mueller's team is very professional. There's no leaks coming out of there. No one knew this was coming. You know, you knew there was an indictment coming on Friday, but no one knew about Papadopoulos, et cetera. So I think there's a lull going on now.
Why do we know? Sorry to break it, but why do we know about the indictment on Friday? Like, wasn't that a leak? You know, all the supporters of the president, including, you know, lots of insiders said that in and of itself was a crime that we even knew on Friday of last week without knowing who was being indicted, that there were charges filed. How did that happen?
Yeah, no, I view that kind of as an anomaly and a couple things. It was Friday. It was a few days before. That may have been prompted by some White House comments kind of alluding to the fact that Mueller might be fired. It could have come from the FBI, et cetera. Should it have happened? No, but I view that as a minor item. And I'll bolster that by saying we didn't know about Papadopoulos for months. So I think, you know, the exception proves the rule. We didn't know about the relevant part guy for months and months while he was cooperating. That's the relevant part. We knew an indictment was coming Friday versus Monday. Who cares? You know, should it have happened? No. But again, that's hardly film at 11 stuff. But to the, you know, to the broader point, I think there's a lull going on now because you're going to have these people who may have talked to Mueller before who are now going to revisit their statements and say, you know, I want to correct the record on something, or I may have misled you, or I may have omitted something, because they know they could be indicted for lying to the FBI. So I think there's going to be a lot of inbound calls to Mueller's office. While that's going on, you've got the Manafort case, which is just going to be a normal federal prosecution, right? Motions filed, motions to dismiss, trial date set, and then see during the course of this if Manafort is interested in cooperating or the other defendant is interested in cooperating.
I found it fascinating that yesterday Manafort's lawyer, Kevin Downing, came out in front of the cameras. He almost didn't wait until he was outside the courthouse before he started to, you know, talk about how Trump had nothing to do with it. I mean, isn't that almost
defensive,
per se, malpractice? I mean, aren't your interests diametrically opposed to Trump's? Yet he's coming out, his lawyer's coming out and saying how this supports Trump's, you know, perspective that there was no collusion.
Yeah, I was struck by the same thing. Who cares? Mildly interesting, but if you're Paul Manafort, that doesn't move the ball forward. 10 to 15 is 10 to 15. So that shocked me. That really didn't do anything. You know, what the lawyers are supposed to say is, you know, wait till the story comes out. My client looks forward to his day in court, which none of them ever really do. But, you know, the president wasn't involved. All right, you got a guy looking at 10 to 15. Maybe look that way. So that was surprising.
So bring us inside the room, because you've been in that room. None of us have, and we always love the insight of someone who's been in that room. You know, what is that meeting with Manafort like if you're, you know, the U.S. attorney? I mean, are you approaching it the way we see it on TV, where it's good cop, bad cop? Obviously, he has counsel present, but, you know, give us some insight into what goes on in that room that we, you know, on the outside never see.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because it is, you know, what's behind the curtain. It just plays out one of two ways, and it depends on the sophistication of the defendant and the allegations. You know, the good cop, bad cop, or good prosecutor, bad prosecutor. You know, in drug deals or drug dealers, things along those lines, that works. And a sophisticated guy like a Paul Manafort, who's been moving eight figures worth of money and has, you know, representation that is very good, there's no need for that. You just lay it out. Here's what I've got. Here are the documents. Here's the wire transfers. Here are the pictures of you. Here are the suits you bought. Here's how you got your money out. Here are the lies you told to the bank. Here are the lies you told to the FBI. Here's your sentence, 10 to 15. Is it 8? Sure, maybe it's 8. Maybe it's 12. But you're 68 years old, and you could hope for a pardon, and we can talk about that in a moment. But at the end of the day, I don't think the pardon helps Paul Manafort if there is one coming, because there's a state prosecutor. So you're looking at time, sir. And at that point, you just cut the deal.
Jeff, you know, why is it always suits? It's always suits that get these guys in. Blagojevich, suits. McDonald in Virginia, suits. Why are they spending so much on suits? I mean, there's so much competition in the suit market. You can get a pretty good custom-made suit for far less than what Manafort was spending.
Yeah,
Kramer's spending a lot on suits, but
yeah, I spent a fair amount on suits, but I look at a Paul Manafort and I think I got to step up my game a little bit. And even Blagojevich was doing the Oxford suits here. And that guy was spending $1 million on landscaping. I'm still trying to figure that out. Those are some flowers. You know, in my cynical way is thinking, all right, there's a kickback going from the landscaper back to him, but he didn't need that kickback. You spend your money on goofy stuff. You saw it in the Jesse Jackson Jr.
Michael Jackson
here in Chicago. Sure. I mean, you got money, you buy stupid stuff.
Wow.
Well,
amazing.
Thank you so much again for joining us, Jeff, on Legal Face-Off. You can learn more about the Berkley Research Group at www.thinkbrg.com. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Take care.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit dlapiper.com.
And moving right along on Legal Face-Off, we're going to talk with a regular guest on the Legal Face-Off show, Amanda Vinicky. And I have a very fancy bio in front of me for you, Amanda, but I'm going to use your Twitter profile. You are a correspondent at Chicago Tonight. You're fresh from the State House at NPR Illinois. And you're a mustard lover, which is important for us to mention because I am too. Welcome to the show.
Very important. Mustard and hot sauce.
Yeah. Oh, both, for sure.
Not together, though.
No, that would not be.
Weird combo together.
There's a really good one. A Plockman's, an Illinois company, makes the Chicago Fire.
Wow.
That has mustard and hot sauce. Highly recommend.
I'm writing it down right now. I guess we'll get to something else, though.
Well, Amanda, you're our Springfield correspondent here on Legal Face-Off. So bring us up to speed first on the sexual harassment allegations. There was a letter signed by a number of individuals, of course, in light of what's going on nationally with Bill O'Reilly and Weinstein. This has got a lot of attention. So bring us up to speed as to that issue in Springfield, please.
There was actually just a hearing right before we were talking that stemmed from this letter. What you basically had was a group of Illinois women who are involved in politics, either as lobbyists, staffers, consultants, and actually also Chicago City Clerk Anna Valencia, who put her name to this letter, describing instances of what they had faced in the state capitol, forms of sexual harassment, some may classify it as assault, just some allegations that I think really speak to sort of a seedy culture. And that led the House Speaker, Michael Madigan, to introduce legislation that is supposed to basically be a crackdown on this, that provides a way for both people who work for the General Assembly, for legislators themselves, but also for, interestingly, lobbyists, because they do need to register with the state, and that is where a lot of this can go on. You have people whose job it is to ask legislators for favors, and sometimes you have these lobbyists saying, we're being asked for some unreasonable favors in return. So this would be legislation that would require annual training, but it would also allow an opportunity, a path for reporting and for punishment. That raises a whole lot of questions. During this hearing, we had the first actual legislator named. The people who first came out with this legislation, or pardon me, this letter, had said that they were not trying to blame anybody in the past. They just wanted to keep things going forward. But then, of course, there's the question of, are you complicit by not naming particularly any elected officials who have taken part in this behavior? And so we did have our first legislator named Senator Ira Silverstein, accused by a lobbyist, one who, I should mention, is running as a Republican representative in this upcoming election, accusing the Democratic legislator of harassment in person and online. Senator Silverstein has told a reporter that he denies the charges. He says that they are false, but that is really kind of the big news. It's sending shockwaves, and the question remains to be seen. Yes, this legislation will easily, I think, pass, but it raises questions about the teeth behind the Inspector General's offices and some gaps there, the overall culture in Springfield, and will this legislation actually change it? And also, will there be more names surfacing of legislators accused of this lewd behavior, groping jokes, what have you? Or, you know, again, there are other questions. Is this what is the truth of all of these allegations? Are there two sides to, of course, these stories? And will they come out?
And great segment last night on Chicago Tonight, your show on PBS, that featured discussions with some state lawmakers and their experience with sexual harassment. Moving on to the race for governor. Last week, Bruce Rauner, who is the incumbent Republican governor of Illinois, laid out his reelection campaign in not a press conference and not a rally, but in what is now commonly the way that people announce that they're running for anything, with a commercial. And his commercial featured him on a motorcycle. My question to you, having been a close follower of Rauner, and you've interviewed him several times, what is his platform besides the fact that he can ride a motorcycle? What will be the centerpieces of his campaign to tell Illinois voters why they should vote him back into office?
Well, I do expect that we'll be seeing more of him on his Harley. His campaign will likely center a lot around what it has really from the onset, and that is the anti-Speaker Madigan. He is trying to put a lot of the blame on Madigan, and perhaps, of course, rightly so, and this is where you would have the critics of Bruce Rauner say, good, and thank you, Speaker Madigan, of blocking his agenda. He even has another commercial with Republican governors from neighboring states saying thank you to Mike Madigan for upping their economies. It does get him into, I think, a bit of a pickle. He is no longer an outsider. He is the governor, so it leads to questions. Well, you're saying that you're the anti-Mike Madigan, you're the guy who can beat him, but why haven't you? Why hasn't your mission gotten through? And further, what does it say when you are continually, you know, dissing the state's economy and its competitiveness when you are the leader of that state and trying to attract businesses such as Amazon here? So he is walking a difficult line. I think that he is going to take credit for the education funding bill, more money going to schools. It is true, he signed that into law, but not until after first very much disparaging that and saying that the original version of that and actually vetoing it. So there's a lot of very tough campaigning that Rauner is going to have to do. What I think you pointed out in that he didn't actually have a grassroots announcement or a tour or anything, we're going to see a lot of this fought over the airwaves because the governor, of course, has money to spend there, and he can keep it on message, anti-Madigan, what he has accomplished, and then he doesn't have to answer some of the more nuanced elements.
So from the Democratic side in the governor's race, Amanda, J.B. Pritzker is obviously emerging as a candidate that we're seeing a lot of. Any quick thoughts on him and his running for governor?
Seeing a lot of him on TV again.
Speaking of deep pockets, right?
Even more money.
It's amazing what a lot of money can do, right?
Exactly. You know, to me, this state race is still very early. There have been a lot of candidate forums, but we haven't seen debates that are getting heavy airtime in rotation. Right now, Pritzker is most definitely the front runner because he has all of that money. You don't have any of the other candidates on TV. So a lot of voters probably couldn't even tell you who else is in the running, but they have a lot of very similar platforms. It remains to me to be seen whether Democrats will swallow Pritzker, somebody who, in many ways, on paper, is the twin of Rauner, just on the opposite side of the political spectrum, in having never held office before, and pointing to his business success and proven by the wealth that these men have amassed as the reason that they would be best suited for that, coming up against Chris Kennedy, who many would say has run a lackluster campaign thus far, but of course is a Kennedy. And then you also have Senator Daniel Biss. Really, those are the top three. Daniel Biss, unions are not backing him. He was out in front of the pension issue, and that is something that raises a lot of questions with the Democratic base. You've seen really unions go more toward Pritzker. But what will that mean for Biss going forward if he does have the money to get his message out and is seen as a progressive candidate? This race could go anywhere.
Amanda, last question. We've only got about a minute left. We'll have to have you back on to discuss gun legislation and the AG race, which we wanted to cover, but there's so much fascinating other stuff. My last question to you is, do you think we'll see other Republicans emerge to challenge Rauner? We already have seen Representative Jean Ives announce that she is running. And to what extent will Governor Rauner signing HB 40, a bill that guarantees that abortion will remain legal, be a factor in other Republicans deciding whether to challenge Rauner?
Time is running short, so if any candidates are going to emerge, it has to be now or it has to be soon. I do think that Representative Jeannie Ives seems to be the one who conservatives, those truly angered by the abortion law that the governor signed, as that candidate. There is another Republican who's declared for the race, Bill Kelly. He is somewhat considered a perennial candidate and has never achieved any success, but presumably at least he will be on the ballot. So it certainly changes that dynamic for Governor Bruce Rauner and makes things more difficult for him. Even if he does emerge out of a primary, he will do so far more blistered than he would without a challenge from Ives.
Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off. Look forward to our upcoming live broadcast from the National Mustard Museum. I assume, Amanda, you're in for that show.
Sure thing.
Okay, awesome. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks again.
Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
And we're back to Legal Face-Off, the Legal Eagles, as Sam always calls you. We're both in studio. We have Rich and Tina sitting here, and we're going to move on to the president of the Chicago Park District Board of Commissioners and a candidate for Attorney General, Jesse Ruiz, joins us. Hey, Jesse, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks so much for joining us today. As our listeners know, you announced your candidacy for Illinois Attorney General last week. Why don't you share with our listeners what made you decide to run for Illinois Attorney General at this time?
Sure. Well, critical point at this time is our president, frankly, who's assaulting our civil rights. And if you recall, on June 16, 2015, when he announced his candidacy, he attacked a certain group. And he said that that group of people from that particular country didn't send their best. They sent drugs. They sent crime. They said they were rapists. Well, that group happened to include my parents, who emigrated from Mexico in the 40s and 50s, and they were not criminals. They were hardworking, eventually citizens of the United States who adopted this country and took advantage of the opportunities it had, gave me advantages that I might not have had they not come here. And so I look forward to defending the citizens of Illinois against those assaults on their civil rights. And frankly, it's personal to me. It's about defending my parents' honor as well. that I think I benefited from that. I know I have. I got to go to the University of Illinois. I got to go to the University of Chicago Law School and study under professors like Barack Obama and Elena Kagan. And so now I want to use those legal skills on behalf of the people of Illinois.
Jesse, the city of Chicago has filed a lawsuit arguing that it's unlawful and, in fact, unconstitutional for Attorney General Jeff Sessions to make federal grants contingent on cities sharing information about a person's immigration status with federal officials.
I'm aware of that case. In fact, my law firm, I believe, submitted an amicus brief in this suit. I believe it was just recently there's some success in that case to date.
Yeah, so tell us your position on that issue and how you would deal with that issue more broadly as Attorney General of Illinois.
Well, again, I our firm, although I didn't personally draft the brief, I was involved in making sure that our firm was involved in that case and supporting our client was Erie Neighborhood House. An organization that's been a settlement house in Chicago for over 130 years. And it should be that way, that, you know, the city should be able to make its policies and not face any repercussions or, frankly, have a hammer hanging over its head from the federal government threatening to withhold federal funds because it wants to be a welcoming and open city, as it's always been. I mean, I was reminded this morning at a breakfast that, you know, the first mayor to put that in place was Harold Washington back in 1984.
Was that the Congressman Gutierrez breakfast this morning you were referring to?
Correct. You heard the same reference if you were there, yes.
So what are some of the other issues, Jesse, that you are hoping to address as Illinois Attorney General? It's a very interesting and troubling time with our political climate, and we'd love to hear a little bit more about other issues you'd like to address.
Sure. There's a number of issues that Lisa Madigan has championed, and I would continue on the well laid path that she's done on, for example, on consumer protection and expand on those, especially as some of the new issues arise, like privacy and protecting the privacy of consumers. I don't think that when Lisa took office 14 and a half years ago, she would have envisioned that her suit against Equifax today, along with many other attorney generals. And so ensuring that as technology changes and more of our information is out there, that it's constantly protected. Healthcare, you know, the Trump administration is attacking the Affordable Care Act and ensuring that folks here in Illinois still have the advantages of quality healthcare. There's a healthcare fraud bureau in the Attorney General's office and continuing to make sure it's protecting citizens of Illinois, and make sure they receive adequate healthcare. Along with that, there's an opioid crisis, and perhaps challenging some of those pharmaceutical companies that are profiting, frankly, from putting opioids irresponsibly into the marketplace and into the hands of patients that, frankly, then lead to abuse. And I think they are well aware that is leading to their abuse. Environmental, it continues, particularly, and then I just came back from visiting in Champaign, Illinois. We're lucky here in Chicagoland that we've got Lake Michigan, but if you go to Champaign, they have aquifers. And so if those get contaminated, there's not a good fix. So we've got to make sure that our water supply is always safe, especially when we see now in hurricane situations, especially in Puerto Rico, that if you don't have clean water, you know, quality of life is at risk, literally at risk.
And Jesse, so let me jump in with an education.
We've got to make sure we continue to protect our environment.
Let's talk about
And, of course, criminal justice reform. Attorney General Madigan has a suit pending, unfortunately, because the Justice Department dropped the ball. Luckily, she picked it up, and she's going to work with the city over the course of time. It will lead to a consent decree, is my thinking, and I look forward to working and supervising that consent decree for many years to come. When I was in the Chicago Board of Education, we were under consent decree with the Justice Department for decades. So there are some cultural changes that have to happen, and we have to work with the Chicago Police Department. There's a lot of great police officers in the force, but there's some cultural changes that need to happen and some work that needs to happen to rebuild and reinforce trust between police and community. And it's something I've always believed in long before I ever thought I'd run for office back in the early 90s.
Hey, Jesse, let me jump in on education because you were the chair of the Illinois State Board of Education, vice president of the Chicago Board of Education. You were also CEO of Chicago Public Schools when Barbara Bird Bennett was arrested. So two questions on education that I think you're going to have to face in the election process is, number one, how are you going to appeal to downstate voters as someone who was, you know, pretty ingrained with Chicago Public Schools, especially given the division that we see lately in terms of the budget, you know, downstate citizens not being happy with the amount of money that CPS is getting from the state and also the, you know, pension issues. Second question is, how are you going to answer for the votes that you cast for the principal training contracts that eventually landed Barbara Bird Bennett, who is CEO of CPS, in a federal jail in West Virginia?
Sure. And I'm glad you asked those questions, because I actually spent more time as almost 7 years as chairman of the State Board of Education than I did on the Chicago School Board. And my entire time there championed a reform of the funding formula so it would be fully equitable. And frankly, there, I've always said, downstate, there's some downstate districts that have even a worse per pupil funding level than Chicago and some suburbs around Chicago. And so it's a statewide issue. And the fact that we've made progress now with the recent funding formula revamp, but there's more progress to be made. And frankly, we need to invest more at the statewide level. And it's been litigated that the state is supposed to be the primarily responsible for public education in our state. And frankly, they've never lived up to that. And so in my 7 years there, I think my record is well recognized that I was an advocate for the entire state, not just my home city. And there were rural districts in southern and central Illinois that need the support as much as every other district. And so we have to make sure we establish a foundation level of funding that's equitable and fair. The other position you didn't mention was I also served on the U.S. Department of Education Equity and Excellence Commission, and this was the very issue that we talked about that is, you know, it exists here in Illinois, but it also exists across the country. And on your second question, yes, there was a contract that unfortunately Barbara Bird Bennett brought before the school board and deceived all of us. She deceived the board members, and she deceived the students, parents, teachers, and citizens of Chicago. And it's unfortunate that was allowed to happen. That was part of the process. It was because there was no mechanism to make sure that she could bring that before the full board in public. She didn't do that. And so we need to make sure that those discussions and briefings of boards are done in public, in full public, which is what, on my exit from the school board, I actually did an interview in the Chicago Sun-Times and said that's the reform that's necessary. In addition, when I became the CEO and took a leave of my absence, worked for free for 3.5 months as the CEO of Chicago Public Schools, I canceled the contract immediately and then ordered a review of the process and how much it was done. Now, that could never happen again because those contracts have to be posted on the CPS website. It was a single source or sole source contract, and board members were told there was no other company that could do this. In hindsight, we now know that's not true, but the world didn't have the opportunity to weigh in on that question, and now they do because they have to be posted for a number of months before any vote can happen, and so folks can have some visibility. So there needs to be more sunlight, which is another function of the Attorney General's office in overseeing the Open Meetings Act and the Freedom of Information Act, and I intend to bolster that effort, especially knowing what I know now and having the experience. I think I'm frankly in a unique position to do this work.
You know, you are in the unique position to get us another amazing guest and come back on the show. I don't know if we've mentioned this already, but you're the Social Works nonprofit kind of pro bono attorney, and that nonprofit was founded by Chance the Rapper. So if you want to come back, Jesse, next week, we'll get you on with Chance.
And you have our vote if you could convince Chance to run for governor.
Yeah, that too.
I leave that to all his friends and all the rest of the citizens of Illinois.
Jesse, in all seriousness, we are trying to organize an AG debate here on Legal Face-Off. So would you come back when we have that set up?
Of course. I'd be honored. Thank you for asking and thank you for making that forum available for us.
Thank you so much again, Jesse. We look forward to speaking to you soon.
Thank you very much.
And moving right along, we're now going to talk to Robert Dunham. He is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Robert, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us today, Robert. we'd like to just kick things off by talking about a story that actually was featured in USA Today recently about how the number of executions has risen over this past year, interestingly, against a backdrop of declining numbers over the past few years. What are some explanations for the generally declining numbers, and why do you think in 2017 those numbers have gone up?
Well, let me answer your second question first. The reason that the numbers have gone up is that last year was an historic low in the number of executions. Executions had fallen from nearly 100 in the late 1990s, 100 in the single year, to 20 executions last year. While there is a continuous long-term trend, the numbers have come down so far that it's not a surprise that they are going up a bit this year. The most important thing to remember is that even though there will be slightly more executions this year, the 3-year, 5-year, and 10-year trends are all still downwards.
Robert, you're again a nationally recognized expert on the death penalty. Supreme courts in several states recently have struck down those states' death penalty procedures. The states include Florida, Delaware, Connecticut, signaling, to your point, a downward trend in capital punishment. Are we seeing the last legs of capital punishment? Are we seeing the end of capital punishment in this country? And why do you think other countries have banned capital punishment when our country is still carrying them out?
Those are a lot of questions.
Yes, they are.
It's called a compound question.
The first thing I think is that, you know, we have a long-term downward trend in the United States for a lot of different reasons. As you mentioned, a number of states, state courts have declared the death penalty to be unconstitutional, but also the United States Supreme Court has declared particular practices that produced an inordinate number of death sentences in particular states to be unconstitutional. So the U.S. Supreme Court threw out Florida's death penalty statute, and then the Florida Supreme Court threw out the amended version of it. Florida, Alabama, and Delaware had permitted this practice in which judges could impose death after a jury failed to reach a unanimous sentencing verdict. So you could have three or four jurors voting for life, and the judge could still impose a death sentence. That practice in those three states accounted for almost a quarter of all the death sentences in the United States. Delaware and Florida have both declared that unconstitutional. Delaware has cleared its death row. Florida's ruling will take 200 people off of death row, and only Alabama still allows non-unanimous sentences. Seven states have abolished the death penalty this century, and so we are down from at one point 42 states with the death penalty to now having 31. And even the states that have the death penalty don't practice it all across those states. We did a study in 2013 that showed that 56% of everybody on death row came from fewer than 2% of all the counties in the United States, and that, in fact, 85% of the counties in the United States don't have anybody on death row. You know, there's a long-term trend. The Gallup poll just came out last week, and the Gallup poll showed support for the death penalty at 55%, down from 80% in the 1990s. So we see this consistent downward trend. Now, does that mean the death penalty is going to go away? It's hard to tell, but I think that we are in the midst of a major climate change in the United States on the death penalty. Every demographic group is less supportive of the death penalty than it was 20 years ago, and the least support for the death penalty is among the youngest Americans, suggesting that it may be a punishment whose time has passed.
Well, so Robert, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you, to the extent that capital punishment continues to exist in our country, which it sounds like it will, I would love to hear what the main reasons would be that it would continue, given what the trends are and given the information that you just shared.
Yeah. I think it's instructive to look at where the death penalty is exercised in the United States. Most of the death sentences that have been carried out have been carried out in a very small number of states in the Deep South. It's important to recognize, although it's very controversial, that there is a legacy of slavery and lynching that the death penalty grows out of. And it becomes more obvious when you look at the past history of the death penalty, which used to be imposed for crimes like rape, but the U.S. Supreme Court says you can no longer do that. When you look at the people who were sentenced to death for rape, it was almost always a punishment imposed in the Deep South. It was almost always a punishment imposed against black males, and it was almost always a punishment imposed when there was a white female alleged victim. That, more than anything else, tells us some of the most critical facts about the death penalty and its outgrowth from slavery and from lynching, and the persistence of the death penalty in those particular states. Almost every other state, almost every area of the country has done away with executions. We've seen executions in Ohio, but there haven't been any other northern executions in the recent past. But even in the South, we're seeing two different things happening. We're seeing prosecutors aggressively seeking to carry out the executions of people who are being sent, who have already been sentenced to death, but fewer and fewer juries are returning death sentences. There have been no death sentences recently in Georgia or in North Carolina or even in Missouri, and all those have been heavy execution states. So at the same time that these states are carrying out executions, the death penalty is withering on the other end.
Robert, for more information on your organization, we can go to deathpenaltyinfo.org. Is that right?
That's right, www.deathpenaltyinfo.org.
Well, thank you very much again for joining Legal Face-Off, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
My pleasure.
Best part of the show, legal grab bag time. It is the most fun part of the show for me and for many of you. Guys, we have a lot of topics to get to this week. 7, which is still kind of the magic number for legal grab bag, correct? We're never going to do 8, never going to do 6.
I would never say never.
With no Sam, maybe we were thinking of adding a few with no Sam.
It's a constant negotiation with Mr. Lenkov. Yes.
All right, so at the top of the list, I don't think I have a link to anything here, but the title is Weinstein, O'Reilly, Bush, Kevin Spacey.
Men behaving badly is
yeah.
the
going to say
that
the thing speaks for itself. Race
right.
ipsa loquitur.
Yeah, I mean, it continues to develop every day. I mean, yesterday the news with
Kevin Spacey.
I mean, Kevin Spacey, who is a great actor in my opinion. Underrated Kevin Spacey movie is Swimming with Sharks. You ever see Swimming with Sharks?
I have not.
Great movie. Anyway, it was disclosed that another actor, Anthony Rapp, who's famous for being in Rent, said that when he was an underage, I think he said he was 14, he was at a party. Kevin Spacey was like 29 or something, and basically sexually assaulted him at a party. And Kevin Spacey immediately issued a statement saying that if that happened, I don't remember it, but I apologize. And I was drunk at the time. And what really caused a lot of uproar was he then came out and said that he has lived his life as a gay male and is now coming out. And understandably, lots of people in the LGBT community have been upset with that statement because, you know, he's using it, in their opinion, as an excuse for committing a sexual assault, as if, you know, him now saying that is an excuse for doing what he did to a minor. So a lot of people are upset. And it continues in, I think, a positive trend of people now feeling comfortable to come out in the open and disclose improper behavior, be it harassment or assault, by very powerful people. Of course, the Weinstein scandal continues. He's now filed suit against his company to get his personnel file. We had Gloria Allred on the show last time. She has continued to sign up accusers. We mentioned Cosmo Goss, who might not have the name recognition of Kevin Spacey or Weinstein, but locally he was the chef of Publican, which is a very well-known restaurant here, and he got fired for failing to act properly in a situation involving a photo. So it continues. I think it's a good trend, again, for people to feel safe to speak out. What are your thoughts, Tina?
Well, I completely agree with you. I completely understand the LGBT community's concern and upset over the way in which Kevin Spacey framed the issue and issued his apology yesterday. I do think that it's a healthy thing that people finally feel more comfortable to come out and address and bring attention to things that have happened to them that were inappropriate. And I just find it interesting, given the political climate right now, that, you know, that this is all happening, because one would say that, you know, in some ways, is this an environment where people feel like they can't speak out? I think it's great that people are speaking out.
And I think what's interesting, and we might have covered this a little bit last time, but is from a legal perspective, the degree to which the companies, Fox and the Bill O'Reilly situation, Weinstein Company and the Weinstein case, are liable, and whether the individual officers are personally liable. I mean, there have already been suits filed against the parent companies, and I think there's some merit to the idea that how can you, for example, give Bill O'Reilly a new contract when you just paid $32 million to one of his accusers, who, by the way, was an employee. So on the one hand, you're paying this money out, and then you're giving this guy another huge contract. Well, guess what? That is pretty good evidence in a civil suit that you knew about it, were complicit in it, and ignored the red flags. And that red flags references, there's a case that says you can pierce the corporate veil and go after individuals if you can show that they showed a willful disregard to what was readily in front of them, therefore causing some exposure to shareholders. So more to come on that.
Well, we move on from that topic to another Trump conversation. This time, a federal judge in Washington has blocked Trump's administration, their proposal for a transgender military ban. Guys?
Yeah, on Monday, U.S. District Court Judge Colleen Cotterly issued a preliminary injunction finding that transgender service members would have a strong chance of prevailing in their lawsuit to have Trump's ban declared unconstitutional. That injunction now remains in place until the lawsuit is resolved, or a judge lifts it. So it's a real blow, I think, against the Trump policy, which seemingly didn't have a lot of thought, you know, that went into it.
Could it be that, like, he announced it in a series of tweets in July? I mean, there's only so much you can do with 140 characters or less.
Right. So, you know, I think if you read the ruling, it was pretty unsparing in attacking what, again, as Tina mentioned, appeared to be a hastily announced policy that really didn't pass muster legally. So stay tuned on that.
We move on from Trump to another equally confusing story. A Chicago judge says that a security supervisor at an Indianapolis airport informed her just this past few weeks that she's on a terrorist watch list.
Yes. Judge Yolande Bourgeois apparently was going through the Indianapolis airport a couple of weeks ago. She was returning from a vacation in Mexico to celebrate a big birthday, and her flight was diverted through Indianapolis. She received her boarding pass, and much to her dismay, the designation SSSS, which means Secondary Security Screening Selection, appeared at the top of her boarding pass. When she was at the airport and going through security, she went through a full pat-down, a search of her suitcase, and she was asked to turn on all of her electronic devices. She found out subsequently, or was told by a TSA security agent, that when the agent supervisor came over to explain the situation to the judge, she was told that she was on a known terrorist list. A spokesperson for TSA said that this designation on your boarding pass doesn't necessarily mean that you're on a terrorist list. What it means is that you're subject to additional security measures and could happen for any number of reasons, including being selected at random for this additional layer of security.
Yeah, so even judges are not immune is the takeaway.
And they can randomly be considered terrorists. That is amazing. We move on to another lawyer in the news. A former big law associate who helped found LegalMatch.com has been indicted over an alleged sexual relationship with a minor.
Yes. Dmitry Shubov, I think, is in a little bit more trouble right now than the judge that we just talked about. So Shubov was a former big law associate. He was at Fried Frank in New York, and in 1999 went on to launch the website LegalMatch.com. He has been indicted for an alleged sexual relationship with a minor. The incident, he was indicted in California and was arraigned last week. He allegedly met this girl when she was 14 through a website that pairs older sugar daddy and sugar mama adults with younger people. The criminal complaint was filed back in May, and he was indicted 2 days later. Shubhav's lawyer claims that the charges are meritless and that he will vigorously defend himself. Unfortunately for Shubhav, this is not his first run-in with the law. He was disbarred back in 2004 after pleading guilty to unlawfully accessing and deleting voicemails from a rival company. I guess if there's any silver lining here, the LegalMatch.com website is alive and well. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it is a website that helps its users to identify lawyers and to give lawyers an opportunity to bid for different cases that are posted and sought for by its users.
So it's not meant to pair up sugar daddies or sugar mamas.
You know, it's funny because I was talking to Sussler about this, and when you see the actual name of the website, that's like your first inclination is to think that it's somehow a match.com for lawyers, but apparently not.
Oh, well, missed opportunity. Maybe we still need to launch one of those. The Turtles are in the news, and not the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. This is the 60s rock band. They lost their royalty battle in Florida.
Yes. So I have to go on record as saying the Turtles are one of my favorite bands of all time.
But you, for all my life.
Are you serenading
right?
me with Happy,
happy together?
We're so happy together, Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're actually a great band. Beyond Happy Together, they had a lot of great hits. So a lot of which were with old Bob Dylan songs. But be that as it may, Flo and Eddie, who are known in real life as Mark Volman and Howard Kalin from the 1960s supergroup The Turtles, lost their copyright case against SiriusXM last week in Florida Supreme Court. This case is actually one of several that Flo and Eddie have filed across the country over the past couple of years. They already lost the case that they filed in New York back in December, and they currently have a case pending in the Ninth Circuit after a California District Court judge ruled in the band's favor. The issue under consideration with all these cases is whether or not Flo and Eddie have a right to collect royalties from recordings that they made with the Turtles before 1972. To the extent that such royalties are due and owing to Flo and Eddie and others who are similarly situated, it would have to exist as a creature of state common law, in this case, Florida, because the federal copyright law does not provide for royalties for music and recordings before 1972. In a unanimous decision, the justices said that under Florida common law, the Turtles do not own the exclusive right to the performance of their sound recordings, and that this is not recognized under Florida common law. So, unfortunately for the Turtles, at least in Florida and New York, they are not going to be entitled to royalties, which by all measures could be in the tens of millions of dollars. So the main issue here, I mean, this is not just for the Turtles. It's for a number of bands that have recordings pre-1972 and particularly are being streamed on various sources such as Sirius. What's interesting is that Sirius was actually involved in a case, and in 2015, they agreed to pay about $210 million actually to five different music companies to settle a very similar set of cases involving pre-1972 recordings. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the California case. But if the New York and Florida cases are any indication, that may not bode well for Flo and Eddie.
I wonder if they'll change the law in Florida.
Yeah, I don't know. But they were saying that the reason why the justices and the court decided the way they did was because this has never been a cause of action or anything afforded by common law, and to do so would actually have an immediate impact on consumers as well as numerous stakeholders that are not a party to the lawsuit. So that was the reasoning of the court.
Wow. And we promise not to use any Turtles music in this recording. We will definitely
be respectful.
Can we sing
some songs?
I can't see me loving.
That's an original interpretation. That's totally fine.
Yeah, that's a transformative work. So
yes.
That's not a copyright
Very
infringement.
Well done.
The tone deaf version.
Thank God we addressed the holiday at least a little bit here at the end. We have two holiday stories. The first, five copyright issues that you should know for Halloween.
Or three, or, you
or
know.
Three, or whatever.
Time gives us like two, maybe two.
Yes, I was going to say, I've got a minute and a half, maybe, to cover all this. So Rich and I are actually going to be talking about a myriad of legal issues that could arise today on Halloween. And it, you know, it's not just a time to get scared out of your wits. It's also a time to potentially run afoul of various legal issues. So the next time you decide that you want to run a haunted house or in any way make money off of the holiday, we have a few tips for you in terms of things that you may wish to think about or potentially avoid. So for those of you out there who are inclined to run a haunted house in particular, think about things such as the music that you play to evoke the mood for a haunted house. Music is typically copyrighted and is subject to copyright laws, which means that without a license, you could end up getting a demand letter from the copyright owner. So usually when you purchase music, the understanding and the implied license, so to speak, is for your personal use, but it's not for a public performance. So keep that in mind. Also, Halloween costumes and masks. Again, to the extent that you are thinking about making money off of a Halloween venture, particularly a haunted house, you need to be careful, especially if these are famous characters. Again, there's an implied license when you buy a costume that you're able to wear it for the purpose which it's intended for, which is a personal use. You know, things like copying Halloween stories that are subject to copyright. Dracula, of course, is not, but various interpretations would be considered subject to copyright if they're...
What's Sussler's costume this year?
Sussler's just Sussler.
Sussler's his own creepy, scary character?
Yeah, we don't...
Is that what you're saying?
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Your fellow Inside Out columnist and frequent Legal Face-Off guest, David Sussler? What's your costume, Eddie?
I'm just being myself,
yeah.
You know, as scary as that
Boring.
Might be. So what are you going to be, Richie? You've been a different thing every week the last month.
Yes, I'll reveal that shortly.
Rich, we're all going to be waiting with bated breath for your costume. I can't wait for the... Is it going to be a social media announcement? How are you going to do
Big
that?
Social media announcement. So
It'll be a tweet, I'm sure.
Right. Check out, yeah, a very long tweet. We move on to one last Halloween story. Three reasons employers should be scared of Halloween. And I imagine it's not just getting into the festivities of the
It's holiday. Because Rich Lankoff is going to show up in a scary costume.
That's right. In addition to the intellectual property issues to be aware of, there are other legal issues around Halloween. One of them, of course, is related to employment law. So if you've got Halloween parties you're going to at your workplace, they are fraught with dangers, right, legally. Everything from questionable costumes. You know, you don't want people wearing offensive costumes that others can perceive as insulting either to a racial or an ethnic group. You also don't want to talk to your workers about their costumes in a way that can make them feel uncomfortable, you know?
You always make me feel uncomfortable, Rich.
Well, that's true. And you're not even costumed. But I've seen cases where people feel as though the questions about their costumes around Halloween made them feel like uncomfortable or made them feel as if it's a hostile work environment. So yeah. Plenty of employment issues. There's also workers' compensation exposure, of course. If you've got a Halloween party, anytime you've got people together in a party at work, there's exposure for workers' compensation. People who get hurt after drinking, or maybe they're wearing a costume that doesn't allow them to see, they get hurt. There's exposure for the employer.
It has a weapon on it.
Weapon, sure. And there's also exposure for over-serving people who then go out and get on the road and might get into car accidents. So the lesson is just stay home. Don't have any holiday parties. As an employer myself, you know, these are fraught with danger, or have a really good waiver.
Have no convening of people other than in court.
Exactly.
Well, thank you guys once again.
Yeah, thanks, yeah. Greg, for sitting
thank
in.
Thank you.
Double duty today, producer and our...
Master of Ceremonies.
Master of Ceremonies.
I'm going to put that on the business card for now. I'm Master of Ceremonies.
Get well, Sam.
Yeah,
feel
get
better.
Well, Sam.
Yes,
ma'am.
If I see pictures of Sam tonight all over
if
Lincoln
he's dressed
Park,
up, yeah. I'm going to have a problem with that.
Yeah. He might have gotten better within
yeah,
a couple
amazing
hours.
Amazing how that happens.
We'll see. All right. Well, we'll join you in a couple weeks, and Sam will be back for Legal Face-Off. Thank you so much from all of us. We'll see you again.